which we see an effect in the women, which is it's up to a face, commonly called informed consent. They would be given forms in English. So then, you know, racist, eugenicist, white supremacist idea of successful, right? We need to get this program of sterilization. Yes. And it happened through, you know, really the fostering of immigrants. You tens of by 1970, you had over a million. So this is, again, the patterns that repeat themselves across time, but I agree that the issue of sterilizations, and which by the way, I you know, I believe still does happen to a certain extent, especially in Native American communities and reservations, where, you know, young women will go to a clinic and next thing you know, they've been sterilized. So unfortunately, not all of this awful history is quite history and is fully in the past.
I'm aware of a similar history like this in Peru. I was not aware that something like that similar happen in Puerto Rico as well, which is all the more reason why we need to have Alberto Medina back on the show in the near future. We have about 3 or 4 minutes left. So Alberto, I want to ask you if there's any other issues or lessons that you want people to learn from your Jacobin article, because we are going to create a link to your article on our Twitter account so people can learn more about the situation. Because as I said earlier, it sort of flew under the radar considering everything that's happening in Washington. But nonetheless, what's taking place in Puerto Rico right now under this second Trump administration deserves our attention.
Yeah, and I think the biggest lesson that I would hope listeners take from this is that this is an issue that it's time for them to get involved with and take a position on. For many, many years, decades perhaps, Puerto Rico has been outside of the radar of even justice-minded, you know, progressive, liberal, whatever you want to call it, you know, well-intentioned people will say, well, that issue is up to the Puerto Ricans. It should be whatever they want. It's not my place to say anything or to do anything. That's not just morally wrong, I would argue, because the burden to decolonize should be on the colonizer, not on the colonized. And it is the United States that is doing this to Puerto Rico. So if you are a voter, a constituent of the United States government, I would argue it is incumbent on you to, you know, promote and to support that decolonization. But in practice, it also doesn't work because it is Congress that ultimately has the power over Puerto Rico. So Puerto Ricans can vote as many times as we want on our political status. We've had 7 votes on it. You know, Puerto Ricans can and have, you know, been engaged in this debate for over a century, but nothing can or will happen if Congress does not act. And Congress will only act if its voters, its constituents get involved in this issue. So, you know, this isn't just an issue for Puerto Ricans to care about. This has to be an issue for all Americans, arguably all peoples who care about justice to not just care about, but to do something about, and to take a position, right? To not just have it be this sort of euphemistic, well, let's give the Puerto Rican people self-determination or decolonization. Those words are, and those concepts are important. But in practice, they don't really mean much, right? There is an actual concrete political position that should be taken here, which is independence. I would argue, of course, for all the reasons that we've talked about, right? And especially because, as both, you know, James and I mentioned, statehood is simply not a political possibility. So to argue or to support or to pretend to support statehood after 127 years, when we know deep down that it simply cannot happen in the United States Congress, merely perpetuates the colonial status that, among other things, allows a Donald Trump to come in and sort of take over Puerto Rico through this moves on the board. So, you know, the movement for Puerto Rican sovereignty, thankfully, is growing thanks to Bad Bunny and others. It's time for Americans and for others to join that movement because Puerto Ricans cannot do it all by ourselves.
I definitely support that movement as well. So, James, I want to give you the last word. We can't predict what's going to happen in Washington between now and the coming weeks and months ahead with this current Trump administration. We don't know how long the National Guard's going to be here in Washington. So, at the very least, I guess the last thing I could ask you is, what can we do next as far as mobilization is concerned? And also, you know, just to tie everything together, the importance of these two issues, both Washington and Puerto Rico, and why there needs to be a sense of urgency for both cases.
I think 2 things to keep in mind. There is a major discourse we are, quote unquote, losing our democracy. Breaking that word into 2, the demos, the ordinary people, the quasher, the power of ordinary people, power to the people. That is what democracy is about. It is about an active citizenship. It is not about the servants, the public servants who are elected by people. So we just can't rely on even the best of our elected officials to take this on by themselves. We have to read the narrative correctly. The Mandani candidacy in New York City, in which significant numbers of Jewish Americans are behind him, this is not about him as an Indian born in Uganda who is a Muslim. He is, that is his identity. But it was voters who voted in his governance campaign, his affordability campaign. They were not saying, oh, vote for this Indian from Uganda who's a Muslim. Don't vote for him because of those identity reasons. They looked at his governance policy and said he is addressing the aspirations. We must bring all of these spontaneous movements against the brutal attack of the MAGA and the Trump administration into some kind of horizontal network of network. Veres teredes. It doesn't have to be one organization, but we have to get a synergy, because they will beat us to death as individual groupings, individual identities, individual employment groups. Lastly, I would say, and please forgive my ageism, that Alberto and you represent a new adult generation of visioning what the United States of America should be, both internally and with regard to its global relationships, particularly with the colonial relationship with Puerto Rico. My generation, I'm a 78-year-old person from the last century, the last millennium. We need to find these young, energetic voices like yours, these visionaries who are applying at a practical level democracy, and join in and be supportive. Puerto Rico in the 70s, when I was in my mid-20s, was a hot issue in the progressive movement, not just the left-wing movement, but in the popular progressive movement. We can make it that once again by looking, as Mandani has, hooking the relationship between domestic policy and global policy, particularly expressed in the major inhumanity going on the planet today, which is the genocide against Palestinians. So I am hopeful, and I ask the listening audience to join this new generation in making America what it should be, not making it great again.
And with that said, we've been speaking with James Early, who's a former Smithsonian Institution Assistant Secretary for Education and Public Service. James, you don't look a day over 48. Thank you very much for being on the show with us.
Good Pino.
And we've also been speaking with Alberto Medina, who's a Puerto Rican-born, U.S.-based writer, editor, and advocate for Puerto Rican independence. He's also the president of Boricuas Unidos en la Diaspora, a national organization of Puerto Ricans in the United States who educate and organize for decolonization. His recent article in Jacobin is entitled, Trump is Launching a Hostile Takeover of Puerto Rico. And we're going to create a link to this article on our Twitter account. Alberto, we need to have you on the show again in the future. But in the meantime, thank you very much for being on the show with us.
Happy to join you anytime, and a real pleasure to be here with you both.
Okay.
Absolutely. You got it. And with that said, that is it for today's show. We want to remind everyone you can follow us on latinomediacollective.com. You can also follow us on Twitter under the name @LMC_show. And of course, live on WPFWFM.org. That's WPFWFM.org. Once again, this is Oscar Fernandez saying thank you very much, everyone, for listening to the show. That's it for today's show. Adios. Nos vemos. Ciao.
For WPFW News in Washington and WBAI in New York, I'm Sue Goodwin. Here are some headlines. Famine is occurring in Gaza City and is projected to expand across the territory. More than 500,000 people in Gaza City and the surrounding area are suffering from famine, characterized by starvation, destitution, and death, according to the world's leading authority on food crises. The assessment was released today by the UN-backed Integrated Food Security Phase Classification, known as IPC. Israel has blocked most food and other aid from entering the enclave since the war began nearly 2 years ago. The IPC calls the crisis entirely man-made and warns that, quote, if a ceasefire is not implemented, avoidable deaths will increase exponentially, close quote. The IPC's announcement is the first formal declaration of famine in Gaza. An Israeli agency rejected the finding. In more news, as Gaza confronts a preventable famine, the Israeli military gears up for another major offensive. WPFW's Noah Portner has more.
The Israeli Defense Force, or IDF, plans to launch a massive attack on northern Gaza, but seeks to evacuate the civilian population before striking. Netanyahu is eager to get the entire enclave under his control and has called up 60,000 reservists to do so, but the IDF chief warns that full evacuation could take weeks. The IDF has been urging evacuations via pamphlets, text messages, and even drones with loudspeakers. Only a small portion of Gaza is left untouched by evacuation orders, with many residents complaining that there is nowhere to go. The starvation crisis will also be worsened by this forced relocation, although what many fear most is complete annexation by the Israelis. The IDF has adopted the strategy of evacuating certain neighborhoods before attacking, although even the so-called safe zones in Gaza are extraordinarily dangerous by any measure. This strategy has forced many Gazans to flee multiple times over the course of this two-year war. From WPFW News, I'm Noah Portner.
And in more news, the Supreme Court ruled yesterday that the Trump administration can proceed with plans to cancel nearly $800 million in National Institutes of Health research grants tied to diversity, equity, and inclusion efforts. In February, the NIH began terminating federal grants for projects that did not align with the Trump administration's policy. The Supreme Court's decision overturns a lower court decision that ordered the grants restored in June following lawsuits filed by impacted grant recipients and 16 Democratic-led states. The Supreme Court's decision means the administration can withhold the funding while the legal fight plays out. And a federal judge ruled yesterday that no additional detainees can be sent to an ICE detention center in the Florida Everglades, known as Alligator Alcatraz, and that much of the facility be dismantled. Judge Kathleen Williams issued the preliminary injunction while a lawsuit against it is heard. A federal lawsuit was filed by environmental groups and a Native American tribe alleging the facility's construction harmed the Everglades ecosystem and the tribe's sacred land. The judge gave the Trump administration 60 days to move out existing detainees and begin to remove fencing, lighting, power generators, and waste receptacles. The state of Florida, which is partnering with the Trump administration in the building of the site, has already filed an appeal.